Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Brenda Davis. Brenda Davis is a registered dietitian, a leader in her field, and an internationally acclaimed speaker. She is the best-selling co-author of 8 books, including Becoming Vegetarian, Defeating Diabetes, and The Raw Food Revolution Diet. Brenda has published numerous articles written for peers in the dietitian community, and also many articles for the general public. For the last 7 years, Brenda has been the lead dietitian in a heavily studied diabetes intervention project in the Marshall Islands. Her findings present further evidence that diabetes can be prevented by changes in diet, and that with support, healthy changes can take root in any community. Brenda is a past chair of the Vegetarian Nutrition Dietetic Practice Group of the American Dietetic Association. So now, Brenda, my dad and I are so excited to have this time with you and to welcome you onto this call. And here to interview you is my dad, John Robbins.
Oh, thanks so much. It's so nice to be here. Thanks, Ocean.
Yeah, and thank you, Ocean, for that introduction. And thank you, Brenda, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us.
Oh, thank you, John.
Many people today don't see that there are far-reaching consequences to their food choices. They don't think there's a huge correlation between what they eat and the health outcomes they experience in their lives. There are just so many other factors that are involved in health, so they simply eat what they want to. Many of the experts who are speaking at this Food Revolution Summit have a different view. They see food as having a great deal of power. In fact, they see food having as potent or even more potent an effect on human health than medicine. I want to ask you what the science says. Do you read the science to say that food really has the power to cause illness or conversely to bring about healing?
Well, John, what we know right now is that probably some 70% of the deaths in North America and probably about 65% in the world are directly related to lifestyle, and one of the biggest lifestyle factors associated with those deaths is the food that we eat. And it's interesting, if you look around the world, you see dramatic impacts of people's food choices. And I think one of the most astonishing to me is a population that I work with in the Marshall Islands. You know, 70 years ago, these people had very little chronic disease. They had no type 2 diabetes. Today, this population is actually being pretty much wiped out by diabetes. Certainly 50 to 90% of the adults have either diabetes or prediabetes. And genetics don't change in 70 years. So something has happened, and what's happened is their lifestyle they've really gone from living off the land and eating foods as they're grown on their islands or catching fish from the sea to living off processed foods. And the change in their health has been absolutely mind-boggling and very, very sad to see. But we know the connection is extremely, extremely strong. As a matter of fact, experts are estimating that 90% of type 2 diabetes, 80% at least heart disease, and probably 60 to 70% of cancers are entirely preventable by diet and lifestyle changes.
Are you learning anything in the Diabetes Intervention Research Project in the Marshall Islands that can provide lessons about how we can help defeat or prevent diabetes in this country?
Oh, absolutely. We know that diabetes is directly correlated with obesity. And as obesity rises, type 2 diabetes rises. And it's interesting, in some countries, I was in Taiwan recently, in some countries, people don't have to gain very much weight to end up with diabetes. Very small weight gains. I remember meeting a lady that was not, well, certainly about my size, maybe 5'2 and 115 pounds. She was diabetic, and her healthy weight was probably 100 pounds with her little tiny bones. And, you know, in some areas, people are just more susceptible. And so we know that in the Marshall Islands, when we took this group of people who, as I mentioned, once lived off the land, and we put them back on a diet that was very high in fiber, that was very unprocessed, the disease started to reverse itself. And what shocked me was how quickly this happened. We saw people who had had extreme pain in their legs. Within a week, that pain was gone. And they could have had that pain for 20 years. It was just absolutely stunning. We saw blood sugars drop 100, 200 milligrams per deciliter within a couple of weeks. Just shocking changes very, very quickly. And so what can we learn from the lessons that we learned there for the people in our country? Number one, we have got to start eating less. Number two, we've got to stop eating processed foods, these highly processed foods. We're literally taking decent foods, removing almost everything of value to human health before we eat them, and then adding a bunch of garbage to them to make them taste better. What we're really good at doing is extracting the flavors that humans are drawn to, flavors like sugar and fat and salt, concentrating those things and spiking our foods with them to make people want to keep coming back for more. And this is just such a deadly combination. So, you know, the good news about the Marshall Islands to me is that this population had so many barriers, it's hard to even wrap your brain around it. They are extremely poor. The women weren't allowed to wear pants or any exercise wear. It was all these long skirts and muumuu dresses, and they had no fitness facilities. They have barely any produce that's shipped in. I mean, you'd think they'd be living off the food that grows on the island, but unfortunately, there's enough food on the island growing naturally for maybe 500 or 1,000 people, and there's 30,000 people there. So they have to ship food in. But the food they're shipping in is just all highly processed. But when you think of that scenario and you think that we could reverse diabetes in some of these people who really stuck to the program, did their exercise, ate healthfully, if you think we could do it there, I just think we've got no excuse for not doing it where we are, having everything, having more money, having more fresh produce, just all of the benefits that we have by comparison to the Marshall Islands. We have no excuse. But to me, our biggest barrier is our medical system is set up to treat people with drugs and surgeries. It's not set up to help people change their lifestyle. And I think that has got to change.
When you speak about how modern medicine tends to treat diseases for the most part with drugs and surgery rather than showing people how they could change their diets so that those problems wouldn't come about in the first place. I'm thinking about the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, formerly known as the American Dietetic Association, which seems to be in bed with the junk food industry. I remember you telling me once about being at an ADA conference and seeing just about everyone walking around with a sugary soft drink in their hands.
Well, you know, I remember that so well, John, because I was actually going to a seminar, and there was a huge cooler full of sodas right beside the door, and I walked into the room, and I swear every single person sitting in that room had either a 7-Up and Coke or Pepsi and Sprite. I can't remember, but anyway, everyone had a soda in their hand, and I actually turned around, walked out of the room, because I thought I was in the wrong place. And then I read the little notice on the door for what it was, and sure enough, it was the right place. I was just stunned, and to me, personally, it is a huge embarrassment that our professional organizations who are really there to help promote health through diet and nutrition, that they would be in bed with these industries. This, to me, is unconscionable. It is a huge conflict of interest, and it undermines our credibility in the eyes of everyone. To me, there's only one reason why the industry would want to sponsor our conferences and sponsor our national nutrition campaigns, and that's because they believe it will improve their bottom line. So when you've got this group of dietitians who should be telling the population to eat less of these foods, eat less soda, eat less of these refined carbohydrate sugar products and burgers and fast foods and so forth, we should be telling people to eat less of them. Why would these industries sponsor us? Because maybe we'll be nicer to them, you know? And the hope is that it will compromise our message, and that's exactly what it does. Of course it compromises our message. We're human, you know? So if somebody gives us all of these big presents, how can we be that mean to them? So we end up, instead of telling people to consume less of these products, we tell people, oh, eat these foods in moderation. Everything can fit into a healthy diet, just so long as you eat them in moderation. Well, these are messages that these companies are a little more comfortable with. Unfortunately, these are not messages that people need to hear. Nobody needs to hear that deep-fried pork rinds can fit into a healthy diet just so long as you eat them in moderation. We've got 70% of our population dying of diseases that are induced by eating too many of these foods. They need to hear, eat less of them. And so to me, our message is being compromised in a way that is unjustifiable. We cannot possibly justify this kind of a relationship. It compromises what our goal and our vision for a healthy nation is really all about. And, you know, there's a good news part of this, and I think the good news is that there are a lot of dietitians who are becoming enlightened about these political issues, and they are beginning to stand up and say, this has got to stop. I think we're at, as a profession, where the medical profession was at in the late 60s, early 70s with big tobacco. And it'll change. It's just going to take some time and some pressure by the members.
What type of diet, if there wasn't this compromise, if the processed food and the fast food and the soda pop companies and the National Livestock and Meat Board weren't primary sponsors of the dietitians' associations, and if they didn't have so much clout over what the USDA tells us about nutrition and educates our kids with in schools, if, in fact, we had a legitimate educational policy that was based on what is good for people, on what is healthy, rather than on what supports the profits of these industries, what diet would we be advocating, and what diet would be best to prevent obesity and diabetes in the first place?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. If you look at the 2010 Dietary Advisory Guidelines, the people who were developing the guidelines, this is the advisory guideline committees, they actually had four main action points. And the action points were, number one, eat less. People need to eat fewer calories. Number two, make sure most of what you eat is from plant foods. Number three, to eat less foods that are processed with added saturated fats or hard fats. They call them SOFAs, solid fats and added sugars. So less solid fats, less added sugars. And number four, be more physically active. Unfortunately, the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee recommendations, although they were heard, they were not entirely implemented as stated because of the power of the industry. But it is not that the powers that be, the scientists, don't get it. They do, and they are advising people to eat a diet that's mainly plants, to eat less processed food, to eat less hard fats, added sugars, refined carbohydrates, and to be more physically active. And it's the same story with the World Cancer Research Foundation, with the World Health Organization. All of the major health organizations on the planet are singing the same song and dance. They're all telling us to consume foods as grown, to consume mostly plant foods, and to consume less processed junk, and to be more active, and to eat less, eat fewer calories.
And yet the industry profits from people eating more and markets foods that are high in calories, high in sugar, salt, and fat, and low in the nutritional components that really we need. So we have a lot of obese people who are undernourished in terms of their cells and organs getting the nutrients that they actually need. They're eating so much high-calorie, low-nutrition food.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because if we look again, the World Health Organization and these organizations that are looking at global food issues, they're finding that we're at a state right now where we have as many or more people who are suffering from a form of malnutrition caused by overconsumption than there are people who are starving to death. And we never imagined that we would ever see this in our lifetimes. But in fact, it's a reality. We are feeding ourselves to death.
I recently saw a new report from the Seventh-day Adventist Health Study on diabetes rates. And it found that the rates of type 2 diabetes were 53% lower for male vegetarians than men in the general population, 55% lower for women vegetarians than for women in the general population. And for people between the ages of 50 and 70, there was actually 76% less diabetes among vegetarians than among people in the general population. This seems to show a very strong advantage to vegetarians in terms of diabetes rates. Do you know what accounts for that?
Well, definitely, no question. Vegetarians have a number of sort of dietary factors that reduce their risk, and one is they tend to eat much more fiber. They tend to eat more fruits and vegetables. They tend to eat more beans, more nuts and seeds. And not only is it what they're eating that makes a difference, it's what they're not eating that makes a difference. So they're not eating meat. Many of them don't eat dairy if they're completely vegan. They're often more health conscious, and so they're eating fewer processed foods. But it is very interesting because we actually have two populations that we've looked at in some detail. One is the Adventist population with the Adventist Health Study in the U.S., and there's another population in the U.K., Epic Oxford. And in both of those populations, it's quite interesting, about a third of the people are completely plant-based or largely plant-based, so either vegetarian or vegan. And then part of the population would be a sort of semi-vegetarian, part being fish eaters, and then the rest being omnivores. But in both of those populations, they're comparing the plant eaters or the vegetarians with people who are also very health conscious. So in both cases, they're health conscious populations. But the results of these studies, even comparing to health-conscious non-vegetarians, are really quite striking. So we have the data on diabetes, but we also just, the results from Epic Oxford just came out on heart disease, showing a 28% risk reduction in heart disease, and that's after controlling for all variables that could be controlled for, like body weight, body fatness, smoking, exercise levels, socioeconomic status, use of hormones, all of those things. And then another Adventist health study, too, just out in the last year, showed in the vegans a 16% risk reduction in cancer, in vegetarians an 8% risk reduction in cancer, and that's, again, controlling for everything. And the Adventist health study also just showed a 63% risk reduction for hypertension or high blood pressure in vegans compared with non-vegetarians. So really quite dramatic differences.
So dramatic advantages being shown here for vegetarians, and even more so apparently for vegans. When assessing any diet in terms of its health implications, it seems there are two considerations that have to be accounted for. One is it safe and adequate? And secondly, does it support optimal health? Where do vegan diets stand as far as you see, Brenda? Are they safe and adequate, and do they support optimal health? And are there any caveats on that?
such an excellent question, a really, really good question. So basically, in terms of safety and adequacy, we know that vegan diets can be safe and adequate. Even the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics has a position paper stating that vegan diets, well-planned vegan diets, and those are the operative words, well-planned vegan diets, are safe and adequate at every stage of the life cycle, including during pregnancy and lactation, infancy, childhood, the works. We know that they provide quite a significant advantage in terms of disease risk reduction. At the other end of the spectrum, however, the issue is that there is some greater risk for certain nutritional deficiencies, and we need to be aware of that because those can be taken care of very easily. And so, you know, on the one hand, we're better off with disease risk. On the other hand, we may have a bit of a greater challenge meeting all of our nutritional requirements. That just takes some careful planning. And the nutrients that tend to be a little less likely to be adequate on a vegan diet are, first of all, vitamin B12, because plant foods are not sources of vitamin B12. And it's not that there's something magical about animal foods. It's just that B12 is produced by bacteria. And our plant foods, we tend to sanitize very well and get rid of any B12-producing bacteria. So it's an issue. And so we need to eat fortified foods, foods that are fortified with B12, or take some B12 supplements. And other nutrients sometimes that can be an issue are things like vitamin D, but that's an issue for everyone. It's no more an issue for vegans necessarily than anyone. Iodine can be an issue because a lot of vegans get very concerned about consuming salt and iodized salt or processed salt especially. So they may be lacking in iodine in some parts of the world if they don't consume seaweeds or other good sources of iodine. And then the other nutrient that's interesting is calcium. And calcium is a nutrient that vegans tend not to consume enough of. Probably about 75% of vegans are consuming under 700 milligrams a day. We probably need closer to 1,000. Probably about half of the vegans are consuming less than 525, so they're in the range that the danger zone. Now, it's simply because I think that people have been educated about calcium sources as being only dairy products. And so a lot of vegans don't know where to get their calcium. And this is something that they just need to take the time to learn what are good sources of calcium in a vegan diet. And what we know is that during Paleolithic era, when the people didn't consume any dairy, people consumed 2,000 milligrams or more of calcium a day. So it's absolutely possible to do on a plant-based diet, but you need to eat a lot of greens, and greens that are not so high in oxalic acid. Spinach and beet greens and Swiss chard are really high in oxalic acid or oxalates. So even though they're really rich in calcium, we aren't able to absorb that much calcium from those foods, as opposed to greens like kale and turnip greens and Chinese greens and broccoli, which are lower in oxalic acid. And we absorb the calcium from those foods actually more efficiently than we do from dairy products. So there are those things. And then we get calcium, bits of calcium from our beans and our fruits and vegetables and our nuts and seeds. And so we're getting bits of calcium in everything. And I can tell you from a personal perspective, I've been vegan or close to vegan for about 25 years, and my mom has osteoporosis, developed it by the time she was 50. I'm 54 years old, and about 5 years ago, my doctor said, you know, you're a slim Caucasian female, you've been vegan, no dairy for all these years, you've got a family history of osteoporosis, I think we should do a bone density on you. And when the bone density came back, my bone density was actually too high to put on the chart. They had to put an arrow at the top of the chart. It was 2.5 standard deviations above norm for my age. He was just stunned. He said, I've never seen anything like this. I can't believe it. But the reality is I've just been really careful about choosing calcium-rich foods, making sure I get sufficient vitamin D and vitamin K and other nutrients that are important to bone health, but I also exercise on a daily basis. And exercise is just basically a way of telling your bones to stay strong. So it's not that you can't have good bone health on a vegan diet, but you just need to be aware of what to do. And sort of looking at the overall picture, yes, vegans I think do need to be a little bit more conscious, but partly that's just because we have been educated about nutrition for omnivores. we haven't been educated about nutrition for vegans, and so we need to take it upon ourselves to get educated about that matter. And that's been my passion, really, is to try to make sure people that want to do this, to want to have a more compassionate, healthful, ecologically reasonable diet, to be able to do so and succeed brilliantly. And that's why I've written these books. And actually, Vasanto and I just finished rewriting Becoming Vegan, two versions, a shorter version and a big monster 700-page or so version, which will be coming out this year.
Well, thank you, Brenda. Your work has been of tremendous value to people who want to move in a vegan direction or a plant-strong direction and do it in a healthful way. When you mentioned the Paleolithic period and calcium and how people then didn't eat any dairy products but got lots of calcium, I'm thinking about the paleo diets. And the Paleolithic period, of course, lasted about 2 million years.
Right.
And it ended about 10,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture. Once we began cultivating grains and legumes and other plant foods, there was a tremendous change in the human diet. Prior to that, we kept no livestock, and everything we ate was wild. Today, Paleolithic diets are the subjects of many books, many websites, and much controversy. It seems to me that the idea that we might benefit from taking our ancestral diet into consideration when evaluating the foods on which our organs and cells and existence thrive makes very good sense. But the diet our ancestors ate was high on wild plants and insects, which is a very far cry from what is being recommended today by most advocates of the so-called paleo diets. You've recently taken a good hard look at all this, I know.
Yeah.
And you have come to some remarkable conclusions.
Well, you know, it's really, really interesting, because basically the conclusion that I came to, I actually just looked at some of the nutritional anthropology that's been done, looking at exactly what people in the Paleolithic era consumed. And, you know, when I looked at the charts, I thought, the nutrient intake of these people is really close to the nutrient intake of people eating plant-based diets. And I thought, wow, I need to look at this further. So what I did was I actually went online to a really popular paleo site, and I took 3 days' worth of the recommended menus and analyzed them. And then I took 3 days' worth of recommended plant-based diets and analyzed them and compared both of those to the actual Paleolithic intake. And what I found is that the plant-based intake came way closer to the traditional paleo diet, or the real paleo diet, than what people are calling paleo today. And the reason is really very simple. The animals and plants that people are eating today bear very little resemblance to the animals and plants that people ate in the Paleolithic period. Our domestic animals are nothing like the wild animals they consume. Probably the closest thing we would have is antelope meat, which is about 3 or 4% fat. But you know what I found very, very interesting is that people in the Paleolithic era ate an average of over 100 grams of fiber a day. That's about double the average vegan. So you know that they were consuming a huge, huge amount of plant material, and the plants were very fibrous. The plants that we grow today have really been selected to be especially delicious, and a lot of them are lower in fiber than wild plants were. And the other thing that I noticed looking at the Paleolithic intake is that they averaged 25% of calories from fat and 6% of calories from saturated fat. That's almost the same as the average vegan diet. It is nowhere close to the average new paleo diet, which is over 50% fat and about 20% saturated fat. So the people that are doing the Paleolithic diet, they're averaging maybe 30 grams of fiber, and vegans around 70 grams of fiber at equal caloric intake. So we're looking at 3,000 calorie diet. Okay, so the people eating new paleo diets are fooling themselves, and I think they're in trouble in the long run. They've done one good thing. They've removed processed foods, and power to them for doing that, because that's a really big step towards health. But unfortunately, they've replaced most of those with meat. And the meat that people consume today from domestic animals, and I don't care if it's grass-fed beef, which I think a lot of them end up not being able to afford and just eating whatever meat they can get, but the meat is very high in fat, very high in saturated fat. A lot of it is riddled with hormones and antibiotics. It is not the same stuff people ate in the Paleolithic era. And if we look at studies, you know, we have a number of really good studies. And one of the most recent studies we have from Harvard that looks at following people for 12 years found that people who consume just one serving of red meat a day increase the risk of death by 13% for one serving a day. Every serving increases risk by 13%, and every serving of processed meat increases risk by 20%. So three servings a day, and your risk is increased by 60%. So it's I think they're doing themselves a disservice. You know, the real paleo diet was mostly plants to start with. They estimated at least two-thirds of what they ate was plant foods, and I don't think paleo people of today are doing that. I think they're really focused on meat.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that a vegan whole foods diet is a tremendous improvement over the standard American diet. It's kinder to animals, it's easier on the planet in a thousand ways, and it's saved many, many human lives. And yet, I've also had an experience, and I suspect you may have also, of hearing some people say that they've been on a vegan diet for a long time, and for most of that time, or even nearly all of that time, they felt great. They were thriving. But eventually, they came to feel a need for their health to consume some small amount of some particular animal product. I'm not talking now about people who cave into addictive cravings. I'm talking about people who genuinely experience that they are healthier as near vegans or as veganist or as essentially vegan than as exclusive vegans. How do you feel when you hear reports like this, and how do you respond to people who are saying this?
Well, you know, if you look around the world at the people who are the healthiest, longest living people, most of them are fairly near vegan, but none of them are completely vegan. So, you know, whether it's the Okinawans or the people from Sardinia or the people from Loma Linda or wherever the healthy populations are, they were largely but not completely plant-based. And we are not at a point in our understanding of nutrition, really, to be honest, where we know for certain 100% that there's not something in animal products that wouldn't benefit us in some way. Like whether it's the DHA and EPA from microalgae that the fish eat. We don't usually go into the ocean and pick microalgae, although we do grow it for people. Whether it's trace amounts of taurine or carnitine that some people may do better on. What we do know is that people are thriving from birth on vegan diets. We know that they have less disease when they do so. So whether or not they could be just a touch healthier by including some small amount, say 5%, and be sort of veganist, regardless of whether or not they do that, whether they're almost vegan or completely vegan, they're still going to be taking huge steps in the direction of improving their health. To be honest, I don't know if there are not some people that physically will do better with little bits of animal products, and I suspect there are. But the amounts they would require would be extremely small. The healthiest people in the world are probably 90 to 95% vegan based on population studies that we've looked at. So I myself have been vegan for about 25 years, and I'm pretty committed to being vegan. I would say I'm extremely committed to being vegan. And I feel great.
And why is that?
Why am I so committed to being vegan?
Yes.
Because I made a commitment to myself about 25 years ago that I would not contribute to pain, suffering, and death any more than I absolutely have to. I don't want anybody to die so that I can consume their flesh. I don't want any animals to ever live their lives in factory farming conditions for my benefit. I can't live with that. So to me, the health benefits of a vegan diet are a bonus. I'm really happy that ethical choices for compassion also really well support human health. And I'm also very grateful that they are what best supports the planet as well. And so that's, for me, it's really about making compassionate choices.
When we eat and make our choices from a compassionate perspective, and we don't want to cause unnecessary suffering to animals, we end up eating a plant-strong diet because animals aren't killed for that purpose. And if we come into it from a health point of view, and we simply want to eat and are concerned with eating the healthiest possible diet for ourselves, that diet that will give us the optimal functioning and the longest health span possible, we end up with the very similar food choices usually. And if we come at it from the environmental perspective, we want to lower our ecological footprint, and in particular our carbon footprint, and be responsible for the emission of fewer greenhouse gases. What happens is, again, a plant-strong diet. It seems to me that we're being shown something when all roads lead into a plant-strong diet, so to speak. In other words, all these benefits accrue. What's good for you personally as an eater is what's better for the world and kinder for the animals and allows the most other humans to be fed because it's such a more efficient use of food resources, of land and water and energy and human labor and all the inputs that make food production possible. So it allows most people to be fed. It's of benefit to the world's least fortunate. When I see this, the way it all comes together and integrates, I feel like we're being shown something of almost a truly profound significance. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. I couldn't agree more, and I think that it's something we've known for some time. It's something that people are starting to learn. It's one of the reasons why the growth of the sort of paleo movement terrifies me. You know, if everybody consumed food in that way where the center of the plate was a huge serving of meat, we would need multiple planets to sustain our population. I can't imagine the suffering it would create for animals. It's just beyond belief. And I just hope and pray that people will start to see this and start to see the consequences of their choices beyond themselves. And it's not about personal purity. We've got to get past that. It is not about being perfect or being ultimately pure. It's about being a conscious human being in the choices that we're making.
Well, making helpful choices can seem like a daunting task in light of the consumer-oriented world in which we live. But I thank you, Brenda, for your wisdom and for your work, because I think you've made it clear that every time any of us have the strength and the courage to make a truly conscious decision, we do something for ourselves that's self-respecting, and we also make the world a better place.
Oh, true. Thank you so much, John.
We've been talking with registered dietitian Brenda Davis, the author of Becoming Vegetarian, Defeating Diabetes, and many other books, and one of the leading experts on how to thrive on a plant-strong diet. Brenda, it's been an honor, it's been a privilege to speak with you and to share your message with our listeners today.
Well, thank you so much for including me.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want access to 23 more amazing interviews, then we have an offer to share. We'd like to invite you to get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, all 12 hours of interviews, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. You can get this entire package and own it for the rest of your life for very special offers between now and the end of the summit. If you want more information, please go to foodrevolution.org/empowerment. That's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you again for joining us. Have a blessed and beautiful day.
And now we bring you a special bonus recorded message. Over the years, my dad and I have had the privilege of hearing from many thousands of people whose lives have been touched by the food revolution. Some of these people have lost extra weight or gained more energy. Others of them have reversed or even cured life-threatening illnesses, such as cancer, heart disease, or diabetes. Some of the stories of transformation are so moving that it seems like they just have to be shared. One of those stories comes from Linda Watkins. I caught up with Linda a few days ago, and this is what she wanted to share with you.
Hi, my name is Linda. I'm 59 years old, and this is my food revolution story. When I was 17, I had open-heart surgery to correct a birth defect. Since then, I have been regularly monitored as a cardiac patient. Antibiotic treatment was required prior to any dental work or surgery. Over the years, I have been diagnosed with scarlet fever, rheumatic fever, congestive heart failure, atrial flutter, mitral valve prolapse, tricuspid valve prolapse, and pulmonary hypertension. I had tried to help my heart disease with a low-carb diet, which was popular at the time, but that only gave me new complications. Then about a year and a half ago, my husband had watched Dr. Neil Barnard's 21-day Kickstart presentation on PBS, and he mentioned that he would like us to try it. He then briefly explained the program to me, and I immediately objected. What are we going to eat? We can't just eat plants. After viewing the show, though, I decided to give it a try for 21 days. Our kitchen was cleared out of animal products in short order. After the first full week, I was actually surprised at how much better I felt. I really had more energy. The transition away from animal products was easier than expected, and we've continued eating this way ever since. While I was by no means sedentary, I started to increase my activity level, especially walking. A few months later, in March 2012, it was time for my annual visit to the cardiologist, which included current blood work. After explaining our change to a plant-based diet, he approved, but said he wanted to monitor me on it. My cholesterol has always been within normal ranges, but it had now gone down a few points lower. It was very noteworthy that the year before, at my 2011 visit, the cardiologist had diagnosed me with atrial flutter. He now stated that he didn't hear anything to be concerned about, saying everything sounded good. The atrial flutter was gone. Next year's annual checkup was then scheduled. I just went to that visit in March 2013, and again he found no problems, not even any leakage from the valves. He said to me that he would still like to check me one more time in 2014. And then he said, "But it looks like you have cured your heart disease." I looked at him and I said, "Don't you mean controlled my heart disease?" He smiled and said, "No, I said cured. I wish more people would do what you have done for yourself with diet and exercise." I was astonished. These were words I had never, ever expected to hear. I am continually discovering delicious new plant-based recipes from cookbooks and other sources, much to my husband's delight. How could I ever have said, "What are we going to eat?" The possibilities are endless, not to mention the benefits.
Thanks so much for listening to today's broadcast. We want to invite you to share your comments and reactions and to engage with fellow food revolutionaries on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/foodrevolutionsummit. Again, that's facebook.com/foodrevolutionsummit. This interview, like all of the interviews in the Food Revolution Summit, will be available on 23-hour replay starting on the hour after it completes. You can get all the details at foodrevolution.org/calendar. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/calendar. To get the entire Food Revolution Summit recordings for life, including the transcripts and the bonuses, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us, and please come back tomorrow for another collection of inspiring, moving, empowering interviews. We wish you health, joy, and lots of good food.